Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 4th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff to be assisting us today are Kale Brown with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bigford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Also let the record reflect that Representative Ruffridge has joined us. Today we have a full agenda of bill hearings, starting with HB 289, a bill by request of the governor. We received two amendments on HB 289 that we'll discuss now. Representative Fields.
I will move Amendment 1. I think it's Amendment 1.
Okay. All right. Seeing no objection, Amendment number 1 has been adopted. Representative Carrick.
I move Amendment 2.
Objection.
Okay. There is objection. Representative Carrick.
So Amendment number 2 reduces a barrier to entry for small businesses by waiving the business license fee for first-time license applicants. And so when individuals would renew their license after the first year, they would have to pay the fee. But the first fee would be waived to help incentivize business creation and reduce barriers to entry.
Representative.
Brief at ease.
Oh, brief at ease. Also, let the record reflect that Representative Wright joined us at 3:18 and Representative Sadler joined us at 3:19 p.m. And Amendment number 2, Representative. Anybody? No? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Sadler?
Pass.
Representative Diver? Not here. Jesus, I'm sorry. Representative Sumner.
I'm last.
Chair Sumner. Oh, sorry. Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Co-chair Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
And Representative Fields.
No.
Chair Sumner.
Representative Sadler?
I'm Representative Sadler.
No.
And no.
No.
So by a vote of 2 yeas and 5 nays,
Amendment 2 fails
to pass. Okay, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move House Bill 289, version alpha, also referred to as 33-GH2319/A, be advanced from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 289 has been or will be reported from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill file. Okay, we're back on the record. Moving on to Senate Bill 89 from Senator Stevens' office. Senator Stevens and staff Tim Lampkin are here today to present the bill. Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for listening to this bill. Senator Gary Stevens from Kodiak, District C. So the bill before you, Senate Bill 89, is truly about protecting our young people, our young children, from becoming addicted to nicotine. It's about clearly restricting sales and possession of nicotine products to young people. As you know, the tobacco industry and the nicotine industry has acknowledged the decline in cigarette smoking, but they've responded to that by a barrage of new smoking options that are out there in the form of mostly e-cigarettes and related devices. They appeal to a wide range of consumers, particularly to young people. And, Mr. Chairman, it's working very well. I certainly do concede the point that these products have helped some adults quit smoking, But they do not, however, end addiction to nicotine. Instead, they provide a new and attractive delivery system while still maintaining the same old habit. This bill, Mr. Chairman, is an effort to push back on the multi-million dollar industry that's trying to addict young people from getting started on these substances. The bill raises the legal age to sell, buy, and use and possess cigarettes, nicotine products, and e-cigarettes to the age of 21. The bill also puts a MOS tax on e-cigarette products. Taxing these products is what has clearly demonstrated in the past to reduce consumption, particularly for making products most difficult for youngsters to buy. Data that we've available to you has shown that we can interrupt the initiation of these products at younger 8 years, that we can help the risk of addiction, and that can be substantially reduced in later life. The bill is consistent with military practices, military policy. Having served in the military, I know that there are a lot of abuses in the military when I was there, and a lot of people got addicted to cigarettes through free Marlboros and C rations. The military policy now has standing orders that our troops have to follow the same rules. So this is consistent with federal laws. It's consistent with local laws. It's consistent with policies on our school campuses and presumably consistent with parental interests. To not act, Mr. Chairman, is to turn our backs on all of these other governing bodies. We have deferred this issue for too long. The time is now to face this new industry to help protect young Alaskans who are being targeted for potentially a lifetime of addiction. Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I have to leave for another meeting, but I have my staff here, Tim Lamkin, who knows this bill backwards and forwards. We've been dealing with it for many, many years, and thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lamkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lamkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I just thought I'd offer the committee a brief history here with a few short slides. The e-cigarettes emerged in the U.S. market in around 2005-2007, coming from China. Originally, this product, interestingly enough, I found that it was originally patented during World War II in the United States, but was shelved for it not being cool enough at the time. There's since been a decline in traditional cigarette tobacco usage. These products, meanwhile, these cigarettes have exploded on our market. As you may or may not know, e-cigarettes create an aerosol using a battery to heat up a liquid of some kind. The contents of that liquid are not always easily identifiable, nor are they regulated. They usually contain, however, nicotine, flavorings, and other additives that are then inhaled in small particulates into our lungs. The playbook is an old one. Using old tobacco marketing techniques, e-cigarette manufacturers have secured their position in our market here for the foreseeable future. All they needed to do was pull from some of their old playbooks. This is what worked there on the left in the 1950s and continues to work in modern day. To date, e-cig marketing has gone unregulated. You can hear it routinely on local radio ads. If you listen to the radio, I certainly have heard them recently, showing their popularity among celebrities, having a sex appeal, and being what cool people do. The branding includes a lot of work on social media. That's sort of the platform that young folks use these days in particular. It's Twitter, Instagram, or what is known as X now, YouTube, to promote their images, including company-sponsored ads that associate vaping with having fun, relaxation, freedom, and defying parents and teachers. Or inversely, perhaps worse, the messaging has resulted in many students and parents, sadly, believing that vaping products as being healthy and entirely safe. Here are a few examples of some devices confiscated in our schools. This was at Anchorage School. This is a very small sampling. I continue to get alerted by administrators, teachers, principals that I've established contact with over the years that this is an increasingly problem. You're going to hear testimony to that effect talk about smoking in the boys' room. That's what's going on, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's pervasive and to a shocking level, having watched it firsthand. It's happening in the bathrooms, in our school buses, and even in the classrooms themselves because of the discreet nature which you can deliver the aerosols right under your shirt and could be passed off as a fragrant perfume or cologne. Without getting into details on the components of the devices, which I can do, I'll spare you that technical information. But here's an example of some online sales. The prices vary. I'll pause here to examine, perhaps locally might be the easiest to compare to. I went this past weekend to a local store just a couple blocks from here and priced a device that's very similar to these and a wide variety of flavors still available in the disposable units, which are the most popular ones, that they measure them in number of hits or puffs. And the devices I found locally were 7,500 puffs for $30. If you do some simple math, I guess I've been asked how many puffs are in a regular cigarette. I would venture to say maybe 10, if that's reasonable. So that adds up to 200 puffs per pack of cigarettes. So a pod here that goes for $30 is equivalent to about 15 packs of cigarettes that they're getting for $30. That's pretty cheap, Mr. Chairman. Finally, here's a slide. This is the infamous Waxman hearings in the early 90s. These are at that time, the CEOs of the major tobacco manufacturers in the United States swearing on oath that these products were that nicotine was not addictive. It was safe and harmless. And I believe we understand the history that it resulted from that. How long will it take, I guess, is the question, and how much harm is going to be done before we discover that these products are not healthy, that they do have toxic ingredients, they're not safe. And I believe you'll find as we go forward in the discussion and the rhetoric on this subject, there's general agreement that e-cigarettes can offer a pathway to quitting smoking traditional cigarettes, and that the nature of the non-combustible e-cigarette products may be safer or less toxic than smoking traditional cigarettes. That shouldn't be translated into assuming that these products are safe. E-cigarettes do not end addiction. They simply replace the delivery mechanism for that addiction. You're going to hear a lot about how wonderful these devices are and help adults quit smoking. You'll hear that members of our military should be able to smoke if they're old enough to take a bullet, that sort of rhetoric. Our military leaders want healthy troops to defend our country. You'll hear that the tax rate is too high. We can get into those details as we go forward. But I would beg the committee chairman to keep an eye on the ball. This is all about protecting our children from getting addicted in the first place. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude the presentation. I know you have a full docket today. I had proposed that we go into the nuts and bolts sectional of the bill at a later time, if you wish. And in the meantime, would request that we move into invited testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. We're going to start with Leon Bridges. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you. I believe you're on mute. Mr. Bridges, we can't hear you.
He's going to come down here.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could just have him call in. Would that be better?
Yeah, maybe that'd be better. We're going to go to April Scott. And then, Mr. Bridges, we're going to come back to you. We're going to go to April Scott. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is April Scott, COTC, and I'm an administrator at one of our high schools, and I've been to an administrator in a couple other high schools. And one of the reasons why I'm very passionate about being able to present or discuss this with you today is I cannot tell you just how pervasive this has become. It is in our bathrooms, it's in our classrooms, it's on the buses. It is embarrassing and scary at just how easy these students are able to get these devices. I have seniors that are 18 years old. Some of the seniors will go and purchase these and then come back and sell them to underclassmen. So, I mean, it's becoming a side gig where they can develop this entire business for it. You have some siblings that'll get it for younger siblings and they pass it off. Students will meet off in the bathroom because, of course, we can't really go into the bathroom and really supervise bathrooms. So they're passing it. Younger students get it, older students. I guess the part that was scary for me was to hear some of the commentary that was possibly being passed around in terms of it's not addictive. And I guess the reason why that's scary is because I actually see it. It may help adults quit smoking, but I have students that have never smoked a cigarette and they are absolutely hooked on these devices. It started off as kind of like they just did it to fit in. And now you have students that they're in the bathroom every 5 minutes, every passing period, and twice during a class period just to get a hit off of these. You have students, we call it puff, puff, pass. They go in the bathroom, they take a puff or a hit off of each other's, and they pass it around. The other part that's nerve-wracking is even though it smells good, which is one of the attractants for the students, is it smells fruity, it smells good. Well, the other part is there's some of these that actually take marijuana THC juice that goes into them, and it's interchangeable. So when they buy these devices that starts off for tobacco and nicotine, it is a hop, skip, jump for them to now be a THC. And the amount of students that are doing this is astronomical. When I first started, I was at North Pole High School in 2018, and it was just like starting to come out. I've been in an administrator role for probably about 7 years now. And I think I'd be harder pressed to find students who are not doing it versus students who are doing it. It is just catastrophic how many students are actually getting access to these. Some of them will go into the stores. They can go into a marijuana store and they can buy the bongs or even some of these pieces just because it's glassware. And again, when you talk to these students, where they started was with these vape pens. And then they got hooked onto the THC liquid that went to these pens. The students are buying them online. They get gift cards. They get gift cards and they go and purchase them online and they get them shipped to their houses. And there's really hard way to find out whether these kids are even old enough to have it. But again, I cannot stress to you enough. It's gotten so pervasive that even our consequences that go along with this, we talk about how it's just too hard to keep track of it. I mean, we'll have kids expelled just from having access to these things if we're talking about doing progressive discipline by how often these students have access and are repeated access or even users of it. And it's, again, because they're just so addicted to it. I had a student, in fact, just last week, I talked to this student, and she says, well, I have to use it to relax. It helps relax me. And she knows that she's going to get in trouble, but yet she can't help it. And that's just one of the, I can't even tell you how many stories that I have like that. So I do implore you, if you don't want to tax this, if you don't want to have something to, I can understand the reason behind it. But then I implore you, help us figure out a way to address this and to fix it. Because by doing nothing, all we're doing is maintaining this playground where the students are increasingly gaining access and addiction to these pieces, which is actually just a stepping stone to the next part that they're going to. We really need help. I'm an administrator in a high school, and I'm in one of the high schools, and it's just not our high school. I've been in 3 high schools here, and every single one of them have the same issue. And I just ask, we need help. And if you don't want to help do it this way, then I ask you to come up with another way to help us, because I can tell you we're losing this fight. We're losing the fight to help keep the kids off of being addicted. I'm glad it's helping adults get off of it, but it is absolutely hooking our youth. And we really need support. Please help us, because we're not equipped to do this, and we're definitely not equipped to do it by ourselves. I really appreciate the time that you've taken to listen to me. And if you have any questions, please, please email me, april.scott@k12northstar.org. and I'll even give out my cell phone if you need it, but please feel free to contact me.
Thank you. Next, we have General Bridges. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Tim Lampkin, Staff Sergeant Stevens, I've actively emailed General Bridges if he can hear us to have him please check his email, and that'll give him a call-in number to use.
General Bridges, if you heard that, please check your email for a call-in number. Your Teams does not seem to be working. Okay, next we have Lena Edace. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay. My name is Lena Edace. I am a senior, and I go to Diamond High School and Alaska Middle College. And I am a teen ambassador with, Youth Encouraging Alaskans Health. I joined the program. We help educate teens and youth around Alaska on the dangers of e-cigarette and nicotine and tobacco usage. I joined my freshman year of high school after being in middle school, seeing a lot of the kids around me becoming addicted to nicotine. For example, a lot of my friends started to vape. And I knew the effects it had on their body because my dad was a previous smoker, and I was able to become educated, and when I saw my peers starting to use these products, I knew something had to be done. So, first I'm just going to start off by talking a little bit about what I see at my own school every day. So, just last week at Diamond High School, they had to open every single bathroom door because the vaping problem and substance use problem in the bathroom was getting so bad that the smells and everything combined was like, it was just like you couldn't handle it. So now, every single bathroom in the high school, the doors are opened. So it's a little bit inconvenient for everybody because, you know, when you want to go and use the bathroom, you don't have very much privacy anymore. But so now, I still see a lot of my peers using these substances in class just because it's so easy to just take a hit from the vape and then just put it right back in your pocket. It's really, like, easy to hide, and the smell doesn't, like, spread everywhere, really, like a cigarette would. But a lot of my peers don't realize how addicting these products are. Some of them don't even know that the nicotine in them is addictive. And it's really crazy how these big businesses are targeting youth like me in my age with all these flavors and all these colors. And I've just seen it just keeps growing and growing. So within my program, we have been doing presentations in a bunch of schools and making videos and sending them down to rural communities in Alaska on what vaping is and what it does to your body and what it does to your brain and how addictive these products are. These products are really accessible to kids my age. Like, for me to go and get a vape right now, I could probably get one within the next few days. It's really easy to just text one of my friends that's 19 or to go buy one for me. So as of now, these products are really accessible, and by adding a tax on these products or by raising the age limit to 21, it'll lower the accessibility of these products and making less kids start and resulting in less kids my age and the younger generations getting addicted to these products. I've seen a lot of like my peers get addicted and then start to try new substances and then just kind of go down this hole where like one product just leads to another. So I believe that I've done my part in trying to educate as many kids that I can, and I will continue to do my work, but I just ask that now it's you guys do your part as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have General Bridges.
I think I made it this time.
We can hear you. Please put your name on the record and begin.
There we go. Okay. Leon M. Bridges, Brigadier General, U.S. Army, retired. I'm calling from Anchorage. I endorse everything that's been said so far. Everybody's on the mark. I support this bill to keep, in particular, our U.S. military in Alaska from working in contrary to the federal requirements of them not being able to procure tobacco products on military bases under the age of 21. I don't know why Alaska would ever go contrary to that, but I support maintaining or increasing the age for tobacco procurement to age 21. There is not one health or other benefit of tobacco use in young people. We all know societal costs to it and to our military veterans into the VA system when they have lung disease and mouth cancers from chewing tobacco, from smoking, and now vaping are continuous and forever until those folks leave the system, which is basically death. I've personally seen far too many of my soldiers, fellow military members, go through cancer processes that could be directly linked to their smoking over many, many years. So I do not support anything that would make it easier for young people, military or civilians, to get easier access to tobacco.
Okay, thank you. Then I see Nancy Mead, court liaison. Is that if you're on, please put your name on the record. And
Mr. Chairman, she's in the room.
Oh, she is in the room. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I'm here just for questions only if there's anything to do with the provisions with respect to enforcement or anything like that.
Okay. Well, then does any member of the committee have questions for bill sponsor, staff, or the court? Representative Sadler.
Thank you to the chair, Ms. Mead. I'm just curious how big a issue is enforcement of tobacco age limits for the Department of Law?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the court system does see some of these cases, and mostly we see a variation in the number of cases filed and then obviously a lower number of those that are convicted for the minors possessing tobacco. Other provisions in Title 11 are enforced by the Department of Health directly, but we do get some citations under these. For example, it's ranged from about 30 to 80 per year of these cases that come in the courts. It is not a huge impact to our caseload by any stretch. The bill does change some of that, and I just wanted to be available in case there was something specific.
Go ahead. If I could follow up, through the chair, Ms. Mead. Often in other illegal substances, the law enforcement effort is to go up the chain to suppliers versus the end users. Is there any strategy in the Department of Law to do that, or you just take the cases as they come?
Through the chair to Rep. Sadler, and to clarify, so I'm the court system, we're at the end of the road. So after the Department of Law decides, and it's usually law enforcement who will file these as tickets, citations, almost like a speeding ticket, but there are also provisions in this bill that allows citations to be issued to those who negligently sell to a minor. So that would be up the chain, so to speak, from the minor, him or herself who has it. And there are several provisions in here in the first five or so sections of the bill about providing nicotine or vape products to a minor. So that would be, I guess you would say, up the chain, as you put it.
Anyone else?
If I may follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. In follow up to Representative Sadler's query, too, that I'd like to point out and make clear to the committee that to a great extent, this bill is conforming to existing law on tobacco and cigarettes. So anywhere we've had for many, many years limiting sales, possession, use, purchase, and so forth of tobacco, nicotine products is now being applied to e-cigarette products as well.
Okay. All right. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Lampkin, and thank the Senate President for presenting your bill. We will set this bill aside and brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 285 from Representative Fields' office. That's an act relating to insurance, relating to mammograms, and providing for an effective date. Representative Fields, please approach to the, put your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm Zach Fields, House District 17. I appreciate the opportunity to present House Bill 285, Diagnostic Imaging Examinations. This bill is pretty simple. It eliminates financial barriers necessary for diagnostic breast imaging to detect and treat at an early stage of breast cancer. So what are screening mammograms? They are routinely performed to detect breast cancer in patients without symptoms, and they are designed to be uniform across the country, so we have even standards of treatment. And who gets these depends on patients' risk factors. This bill also covers diagnostic imaging that is necessary to follow up on mammograms. This legislation simply prohibits patient cost sharing based on data that such cost sharing inhibits use of diagnostic imaging and therefore, unfortunately, reduces the rate at which breast cancer is detected early and treated when it is both more likely to save a person's life and more likely to result in early cost-effective treatment. Unfortunately, there is a very high incidence of breast cancer. 540 new cases are expected to be diagnosed this year in Alaska, and it accounts for one out of every three cases statewide. Unfortunately, in Alaska, we have seen lower screening rates than in other parts of the country. Like I said, the evidence is that, unfortunately, patients' financial situation is having an impact on who has diagnostic imaging right now. And my view is everyone should have access to preventative care regardless of income, particularly when early detection and treatment actually can save money for state plans. It's also worth noting that there are high rates of breast cancer among Alaska Native women. higher than among the general population. So this slide just lays out here how early detection can save money. Obviously, it can save lives. I think it's a fair question, what are other states doing in terms of ensuring access to diagnostic imaging? And as you can see, many states across the country have already enacted legislation on this. And Mr. Chairman, happy to turn my staff for sectional analysis or invited testimony. Appreciate the Komen Foundation for bringing the need for this issue forward. Thank you.
You can go ahead and proceed with the sectional analysis.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff to Representative Fields. I will now read the sectional. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 2142.375E to define diagnostic breast examination and supplemental breast examination and offers guidelines for the basis of additional testing. Section 2 adds a new subsection to Alaska Statute 2142.375, guaranteeing that mammography screening, diagnostic breast examinations, and supplemental breast examinations are covered by applicable health insurance plans, with the exception of high deductible health plans that are eligible for a health savings account tax deduction. Section 3 amends the law of the state of Alaska by applying Section 1 and Section 2 to an insurance policy or contract on or after the effective date of the law. Oh, sorry. Section 4 amends the law of the state of Alaska to allow the Division of Insurance to adopt regulations necessary to implement this act under Alaska Statute 4462. Section 4 takes effect immediately under Alaska Statute 0110070C. Section 6, this act takes effect January 1st, 2025.
Okay, thank you. I guess we'll move on to invited testimony. We have Lori Winghire in the room. Oh, for questions? Okay, thank you. Well, then we have Kirsten Smith. If you can hear me, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Smith, and I am the Regional Policy Manager for the Pacific Northwest for Susan G. Komen. Our mission is to work towards a world without breast cancer. I'm speaking today in support of HB 285. As you heard, this bill impacts individuals who have commercial health insurance regulated by the state of Alaska. It does not require coverage, but prohibits cost sharing for existing coverage. In other states, this bill impacts state premium payments for public employees. The bill before you does not, at the request of the Division of Insurance, because of Alaska's unique structure of delivering benefits for this population. And I'm prepared to talk more about that, but I'm really happy that Director Hire is in the room, and she is much more qualified to do that if you have questions. This bill applies to medically necessary breast diagnostic imaging tests, which come between a screening mammogram and biopsy. They are used for two purposes: to help diagnose an abnormality previously found in a patient, or as the primary or supplemental screening for patients at high risk for breast cancer. Women and men skip diagnostic tests for breast cancer because they just can't afford them, even with insurance. It may be a very small spot identified by the screening mammogram, or a breast cancer survivor may need an annual test to identify a reoccurrence. But if the patient can't afford the low hundreds to low thousands of dollars out of pocket for the test, it doesn't get done. While not all of these patients will ultimately be diagnosed with breast cancer, many will. And those who are diagnosed late will face higher costs and worse health outcomes than those who can pay for early testing. Some of these patients will be diagnosed so late that they will face a terminal diagnosis. These are lives that can often be saved. Here's the difference between an early and late diagnosis. Breast cancer diagnosed at stage 1 has a 99% survivability rate, while stage 4 breast cancer, also known as metastatic breast cancer, can be treated, but is almost always eventually terminal. Getting patients diagnosed earlier bridges this gap and allows more to survive. Breast cancer is killing too many women in Alaska. 1 in 8 women across the country are diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. That's 12.5% of all women, or 43,680 female Alaskans who are alive today. Men account for 1% of all breast cancers, and they will be impacted by this bill as well. Today, who survives breast cancer too often depends on a person's income, how far they live from an urban center, and very often on their race. This bill posits that all patients should be able to benefit from testing and early diagnosis. And I do have some statistics about Black women and Alaska Native women that I'll put in my written testimony and edit it, and I won't do that here. When talking about this bill, we typically get two questions. First, will it raise premiums? The answer is that it will. In other states, these cost estimates have ranged from pennies to tens of cents per enrollee member per month. That said, we believe that these tests save more in long-term healthcare costs than they cost in the short term. This is because premiums, as with so much of our healthcare, are based on annualized balance sheets that do not take into account longer health outcomes. The fact is, cancer caught early is less expensive to treat. It requires less intervention and fewer hospital stays, and these events can range over multiple years. In addition, patients will pay less out-of-pocket medical costs and personal costs such as transportation, childcare, and lost wages. Finally, the second question we receive is, why should we do this for breast cancer? What I can tell you is that breast cancer is prevalent, it's deadly, and the tests are high-tech and therefore prohibitively expensive even for those with insurance. According to the CDC and the National Cancer Institute, breast cancer has the highest overall treatment cost of any cancer. It is a disease that can be significantly mitigated by early detection and quick diagnosis. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the invited testimony I see. Do committee members have questions for Representative Fields or Representative Prox?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm to Representative Fields or whomever, I guess. It seems odd that the insurance companies would not do this voluntarily. Do you have any idea why this isn't happening voluntarily?
I might ask Director Wingheyer to address that. Thank you.
For the record, Lori Wingheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Through the chair to Representative Prox. In our current statutes, we define that insurers must cover mammograms. But what we don't define are these more extended mammograms that because of your age or because of a test you got under your original mammogram. So we do, let's say, the low dose or the entry mammogram. But if there's a concern that you need further testing, we don't define it in statute right now without copays.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, through the chair, give Representative Prox just an idea of the number of people for whom these diagnostic imaging tests are important. So data are a couple years out of date, but roughly 84,000 Alaska women are in an age range where they should be receiving screenings. 68% of those are receiving screenings currently. That's 8% below the national average. So unfortunately, even this initial level of screening, we're not up to where we should be. But even at that lower rate of screening, 12% of those who have received the more basic mammogram are referred for diagnostic testing. So that's almost 7,000 women. And then a full 21% of those are unable to pay. So we're looking at a group of roughly 1,500 people, individuals who aren't getting these diagnostic screenings that they should be getting simply because of cost, which is the very narrow issue addressed in this bill. So we're looking at a population of about 1,500 people for whom we would be solving a very real problem.
Thank you. Follow up?
Go ahead.
Right, thank you. I don't dispute the statistics, and I'm accepting that it is a cost-saving measure in the long run. What puzzles me, if those two things are true, why do we have to tell somebody to do what seems to make perfectly good sense to do?
Through the chair, I don't know.
Have we asked any insurance companies?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I have not. I don't know if Komen Foundation is engaged in that kind of discussion with insurance companies.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Wingheyer, I just want to clarify. So right now, state law 2142.375 says that any private insurer must cover mammography and a mammogram.
To the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
And the patient is responsible for a copay provision, correct?
through the chair, that's correct.
A series of questions that I made, Mr. Chair. So this does this supplemental exams, and I'll ask more about that definition in a second, but right now the presumption of the bill is the state does not require insurance companies to provide coverage for supplemental exams. Is that correct?
That is correct, through the chair.
Thank you. And through the chair again. And what about biopsy, which is kind of the third stage or third step in diagnosis and testing for breast cancer? Does state law require private insurers to cover biopsies?
Through the chair, yes, they do. I will have to get back to you and check on the copay on the biopsy as opposed to the testing. I would think that would be one and the same, but I will get back to you to confirm on that, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. If I may, and a question through the chair to the maker, to the sponsor, rather. There's the definite, the second big element is supplemental breast examination based on other factors that may increase the insured's risk of breast cancer. I don't know if there's a definition of other factors. Can you help us understand what those other factors might be or where we could find a citation for them?
Sure. Through the chair, approximately 15% of women are considered high risk for breast cancer. How does one define high risk? Genetic ties to breast cancer in a first degree relative or previous breast cancer survivor. And I would hope that Director Wing-Hire would fill in any pieces I might have missed for that. Thank you.
Through the chair, we would add to that, to what Representative Fields just said, that perhaps their lifestyle, being a smoker, would add to allowing for a supplemental breast examination. But certainly some lifestyle factors that would increase the risk, as well as family traits.
Okay. And follow-up? Follow-up question?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I would, through the chair, I'd feel more comfortable if we had some definition of other factors. There may, in fact, be other factors. I won't dispute that, but it's pretty broad that other factors that may, one could make a case that many, many, many things may increase, but there's no necessity of any cause or relationship. So if we wanted to scope this a little more finely to define other factors that may increase the risk of breast cancer, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask if the Komen Foundation has any thoughts on that based on how other states address this? Thank you.
Yeah, Kirsten Smith, if you heard that question, or it looked like you might have wanted to follow up on Representative Prox, go ahead and put your name on the record and you can address those.
Yeah, Kirsten Smith, Susan G. Komen. The definition of supplemental, that's a great question. Representative Fields read the definition that we normally see in a state's language. Other factors is not defined, as far as I know. I will look into that to see what the definition is. But that's a great question. Generally, we consider supplemental those three factors, which are first-degree relative with breast cancer, a gene genetic tie to breast cancer, or a previous breast cancer survivor.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I did have something to say to Representative Prox's question, but I've forgotten what it was.
Well, Representative Prox, did you want to restate your question?
Thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, I accept the statistics and that this is a, this would end up saving costs for insurance carriers in the first place. So my question is, have they explained why they're not doing this voluntarily?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Prox. My discussions with insurance companies in the Pacific Northwest, where I work, and I think it's similar across the country, has been that they don't dispute that this treatment would help in treating breast cancer or diagnosing breast cancer, but they have concerns about the slippery slope, that other diseases would come forward and say, hey, this is a great idea for ours as well. We haven't seen that in any of the states that have so far passed this legislation, but they, in one state that I worked in Oregon, they pronounced it opposition light, and it was based on that fact alone, is that they were concerned that this would be something that they would be asked to repeat.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Wing-Hire, just give us, this bill addresses private insurance. Just give us kind of an overview of how many Alaskans are covered by private insurance versus public insurance. Just make sure we understand like what portion of the universe of the Alaskans this might cover.
Again, for the record, this is Lori Wing-Hire with the Division of Insurance. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the Division of Insurance estimates that in the market of the plans we regulate is no more than 15% of the population of the entire state.
Are covered by private insurance.
Correct.
Okay. And if I may follow, and what percentage of, does the state of Alaska do public insurance programs cover the supplemental breast examination and diagnostic breast examination as defined in this bill so far?
Through the chair, I would have to look to the sponsor, but I don't believe this extends beyond regulated plans under Title 21. I'm assuming you're asking about Medicaid and Alaska Care and such?
Yes, ma'am. But through the chair, my question is, absent this bill, is this coverage provided to people who are insured by other than private insurers?
Through the chair, no, Representative Sadler. This bill is targeted at the market that the director described.
So we're looking at 15% of the population, but leaving out another 85%? Or? That's a question.
Through the chair, I would certainly welcome bringing in Emily Ritchie to talk about the state plan. Thank you.
But you didn't, so okay.
Okay, any other questions? No? Okay.
Well, I guess.
Representative Prox.
I don't know if it's Emily Ritchie, but I would guess we would want the answer to the state employees plan at least. Because apparently we're going to save money if we require the state employees plan to adopt this.
Through the chair, I will follow up with Emily Ritchie.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right. Well, seeing no other questions before the committee, we're going to set this bill aside for a future date. Next on the agenda is House Bill 203, a bill sponsored by my office. I'm going to ask that my chief of staff, Clark Bickford, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin.
Mr. Chair, 203 is which one?
Oh, excuse me, an act relating to wage payment. So,
thank you.
Payroll cards.
excuse me. Thank you, Chairman Sumner. For the record, Clark Bickford, staff to Chair Sumner. I'm here today to present on HB 203. In Alaska, current law does not permit an employer to select an electronic payroll deposit system unless and until every employee specifically elects to be paid electronically. In other words, an employer who wishes to move the company to an electronic wage payment may not be permitted to do so. Any given employer may have very good business reasons to switch the company's payroll system, including business efficiency, cost savings, environmental concerns about excess paper usage, or security of wage payment transactions. Those employers in the private sector who elect to move to an electronic payment system should be entitled to do so. That decision rests with the employer, as with any of the many work-related conditions of employment. The choice for an employer to pay employees via electronic means is no different and should be permitted if the employer so chooses. Note that nothing in the proposed legislation would require an employer to switch to electronic payment of wages. It will simply authorize that decision if the employer elects to do so. Any employer who wishes to continue paying employees with traditional paper paychecks may still do so. Should an employee either not have a bank account or prefer an alternative to electronic funds transfer, that employee would elect to be paid via payroll card instead, and that payroll card would be issued under a Visa or MasterCard partner and would operate just like an ATM card, now accepted in lieu of cash almost universally. The payroll card is FDIC insured and secure for the employee receiving payments in this way. With the permission of the chair, I would like to go over the sectional analysis.
Go ahead.
Section 1 of HB 203 would amend AS23.10.040 to require employers to pay wages or other compensation with lawful money of the United States, or with negotiable checks, drafts, or orders payable upon presentation without discount by a bank or depository inside the state. Section 2 would add a new section to AS23.10 to allow employers to pay wages by credit to a payroll card if the employee has voluntarily authorized the credit or has not authorized deposit of the employee's wages under AS23.10.043. The section would also require employers to notify employees of their wage payment options and the payroll card terms, conditions, including the fees associated with using a payroll card account. With the chair's indulgence, we have Dan Smith available online to give invited testimony and answer any questions.
I see Dan Lewis.
Sorry, that was a mistake. Dan Lewis.
Dan Lewis, if you'd like to put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
For the record, Dan Lewis. I'm Vice President of Government Relations at ADP. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for offering me an opportunity to speak briefly in support of HB 203. As mentioned, I'm testifying on behalf of ADP, which is the nation's largest provider of human capital management solutions, and we pay one in every six U.S. employees. As such, ADP is uniquely positioned to understand the importance of supporting electronic pay and transitioning away from paper. HB 203, which ADP strongly supports, would eliminate the requirement that Alaska employers offer paper paychecks as a form of wage payment. Under the bill, employers would have the right to offer employees payment options by direct deposit or payroll cards. We think this will benefit employers from a payroll management and expense perspective, while also providing significant benefits to employees. To be clear, nothing in the bill prevents employees from continuing to receive pay by direct deposit, and employers could offer paper paychecks if they so choose. Further, the bill protects the right to collective bargaining arrangements and does not impact regulations for payment of wages to state employees. There are much better alternatives to paper paychecks at this stage. Advances in technology have improved how employees can be paid more timely, consistently, and securely. For starters, electronic pay protects employers. Under certain circumstances, it could be effectively impossible for employers to comply with wage payment laws requiring the timely payment of wages if they must offer paper paychecks. Too often, employees who receive paper checks cannot get paid on payday if there are events preventing the timely issuance of paper pay, such as all too common weather events in Alaska. Electronic payments eliminate this concern. In addition, HB 203 will make payment of wages better for employees. Paper checks can interfere with workers' financial security decisions because they do not allow for easy and timely access to wages. Employees often take extra steps to travel to the workplace to receive paper checks, travel to a bank to deposit the checks, and wait for the checks to clear. If the mail is slow, employees may not receive their pay on schedule. And some employees use costly check cashing stores and then carry their entire paycheck in cash, which is subject to loss or theft. Further, even employees who don't qualify for a bank account can get payroll cards from their employers. Payroll cards also offer employees better consumer protections and convenience. Employees can use payroll cards anywhere they would use a check, including free online bill payments and internet shopping, and it can be used for things such as travel arrangements that require electronic payments. Further, unlike paper checks, payroll cards provide protections from fraud or unauthorized use, and in addition, provide free associated savings features and financial wellness tools. Finally, workers cannot overdraw their payroll card accounts, so there are no overdraft fees attendant to payroll cards. Passing HB 203 will enable Alaska to align with the fact that most payments are already electronic. Virtually all government payments are electronic, including tax refunds and Social Security payments. And according to the National Automated Clearinghouse Association, 93% of American workers are already paid by a direct deposit. In addition, most states already allow for electronic pay as the only option for employees. This has been an effective means of pay in more than 30 states in the U.S. that permit electronic wage payments. From our experience, employees quickly adapt and are often thankful for the change. I'm hopeful this information and testimony in favor of HB 203 is helpful as the committee evaluates how to proceed. Once again, I thank you for granting me time to speak today, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Lewis, help me evaluate your testimony a little bit. What is ADP, and what does it stand for, and what does it actually do, so a layman could understand what you do?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. So ADP is Automatic Data Processing, Inc. We're headquartered in New Jersey, and we operate in all 50 states and throughout the globe. And we are an HCM company, human capital management company, specializing in payroll. Of course, that's how we got started 75 years ago. But in addition, time and attendance support, retirement services, and the like. So sort of a full suite of benefits that would help employers and employee with all the things attendant with working.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Fields. Thank you through the chair to the testifier. I'm not that familiar with these cards, and I'm just curious about kind of basic logistics. Can you go to a store and buy groceries? Are the deposits FDIC insured? How do they interact with your bank accounts or credit cards? Things like that. Thank you.
Sure. Through the chair, thank you for the question. So they operate, you know, similar to any other sort of debit or sort of Visa card that you might see out there. So they are independent from a bank account. The cards are funded directly with the full amount of pay that any employee would receive. The employees can then transfer the funds to other accounts, like to their bank account, or if they wanted to make a payment to a credit card in order to pay down a credit card. In addition, anywhere where a Visa or MasterCard would be accepted, you would be able to go in and use your payroll card just as you would any other sort of debit or credit card that you would use. And in terms of the card itself, there's no usage fees with that. So it would be free to the employee to use the card for purchases and other transactions. And in addition to, if they wanted to withdraw the funds from the card, they could go in and get the full value of what was deposited in the card with no fee.
That's a good follow-up. Go ahead, Representative Fields.
It's also FDI insured. Sorry, I know that was part of the question as well.
Okay, through the chair, thank you. What in these other states that have enabled this, what density do you see in terms of percentage of employees who use this versus, say, direct deposit to accept their pay? Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. I don't have those statistics with me. I can go and look into that and follow up for the committee.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Lewis. And, you know, one of the benefits of a paper payroll check, and I've gotten myself in the past, is it provides you with your gross, your deductions, your tax, your FICA, et cetera, et cetera. Does the payroll card allow an employee getting paid through a payroll card to have access to those deductions or to find a statement? Or is there any accumulation that they could easily access online to find out how much of their pay had been withheld for various purposes?
The chair, thank you for the question. So yes, there would essentially be like an electronic portal that they'd be able to access in order to get exactly all the same information that you would get on a paper paycheck. It would be the same thing as with direct deposit, where, you know, most employees don't get paper paychecks anymore, and they access their company portal in order to see all the details for their pay, all the withholdings, balance, etc. So that's all available through an electronic portal. Where all the same information that you would have historically gotten on a paper paycheck, you'd be able to see. The employees have free access and unlimited access to that. So they'll always be able to determine the balance of their card, make sure they don't run into any issues with shortage of funds, et cetera.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? No? Okay, seeing no other questions, we're going to set this bill aside for future hearing. Last on today's agenda, thank you, Mr. Bickford. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Last on today's agenda is House Bill 290, a bill by request of the governor. We are going to open HB 290 for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 290? No? Okay. I see no one online. Well, we will close public testimony. And we are going to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 290 for Thursday, March 7th at 11 a.m. and bring the bill back up at a future date. So that concludes our business today.
Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:25 p.m.